Today we're going to talk about the rise of Christianity in the Roman Empire and its impact, I would say its devastating impact, on Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael. So towards the end of the 3rd century, Diocletian became the emperor of Rome, and he stabilized the Roman imperial rule, which was in a state of anarchy for many years throughout the middle of the 3rd century, and therefore the roads were safer. However, a new force began to rise on the political horizon, and that was the church militant, whose beginnings may be said to have begun from the recognition of the Christian religion by Constantine. In the year 313, the Roman Emperor Constantine announced that, quote, it was proper that the Christians and all others should have liberty to follow that mode of religion which to each of them appeared best. Now, from this time on, Jewry in Eretz Yisrael had to wage a two-fronted political and religious defensive, not only against the pagans, but also against Christians as well. See, paganism, by its very nature, admitted the existence of national religions. So the Roman authorities recognized in principle and generally also in fact the Jewish religious existence in the land of Israel. Now, with Christianity's rise in power and its eventual status of the official religion of the empire, a basic change took place in the relations between the Jews and their environment. Christianity, as a monotheistic religion, neither recognized nor tolerated other religions, and it claimed a double inheritance from spiritual Israel and the pagan world, endowing it with both the spiritual and political right to rule. Now, the church took a special interest in attempting to bring Jews into its fold, but Judaism was not prescribed in the Christian Roman Empire. Among church fathers, and particularly in the doctrine of St. Augustine, who lived from 354 to 430, the prevailing explanation was that Judaism should be allowed to survive in order to bear scriptural witness to the truth of Christianity. And St. Augustine argued that Jews remained what he called sub lege, which is under the law, not sub gratia, which is under grace. He argued that history has surged to a new stage, but the Jews have chosen not to follow this new stage, and therefore they will be cursed. He claimed that the Jews have the mark of Cain, and it is viewed as a mark of shame. But according to St. Augustine, it also serves as a warning to anyone who comes upon him that the murderer stands under the protection of God. And St. Augustine claimed that the books of Tanakh contain proofs towards the truth of Christianity. And authentic proof towards Christianity came from Jewish books. Christianity saw as its task the elimination of paganism, but it recognized the existence of Judaism in this world in the belief that the general conversion of the Jews was a matter for the world to come. The truth is that St. Augustine's doctrine provided authority for later learned churchmen in the violent world of medieval Europe to diffuse Christian violence against the Jews. Again, he held that we needed Jews to bear witness to the truth of Christianity, and he claimed that their books demonstrated that the truth of Christianity. So he needed the Jews, he needed the books, and therefore he needed them alive. And again, this was very helpful for Jews when the mob wanted to attack the Jews, certainly during the Crusades. Again, some Christian leaders used this argument to defend the Jews. At the end of the 4th century, there were instances of forced conversion, which were to become more frequent in the course of time, but it never became the official policy of the Christian state. Although the church never officially prescribed Judaism, it consistently fostered hatred and contempt for all that was Jewish, both because of the painful separation between these two religions and because of the fact that the Christian world had absorbed much of the hateful attitude that had prevailed among the Roman aristocracy of the pagan empire. In respect to the land of Israel, Christianity claimed ownership of what it regarded as its holy land by virtue of the Jewish past, of which it claimed to be the heir. The fact that Eretz Yisrael contained Christian sites of the crucifixion, the Holy Sepulchre, and other holy sites. And also the premise that with the destruction of Jerusalem and the rejection of Jewish people by God, the entire covenant, including the promise of the land of Israel, became vested in Christendom. That's why the creation of the Jewish state, the modern Jewish state, was such a blow to Christian theology of the rejection of Jews. Now, from the year 315 and on, anti-Jewish measures were included in Constantine's legislation. There were edicts that forbade the conversion of males to Judaism, that required Christians or pagan slaves circumcised by their owners would be freed automatically, and that protected Jewish converts to Christianity against persecution by the Jews, and edicts also that banned the Jewish pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Now, Constantine's son and successor, Constantius, was a far weaker emperor than his father had been, and he became increasingly dependent on his ecclesiastical counselors, who were always concerned to prevent any Jewish influence from being exerted on Christians, and therefore his policy in Christian affairs was explicitly more anti-Jewish. His decrees extended the prohibition against Jewish proselytism to include women. It forbade marriage between Christians and Jews. It gave greater protection to converts to Christianity, and forbade Jews from owning non-Jewish slaves, whether they were Christian or not. Now, this was a severe blow to the Jews in the economic circumstances of the times. And in an attempt to disrupt the order of the Chagim and to prevent Christians who wished to celebrate Easter on the first day of Pesach, the imperial authorities prevented rabbis from meeting to proclaim new moons and leap years and from sending messengers to the diaspora communities to inform them of their decisions. Presumably, these prohibitions were one of the reasons that caused Hillel II in the year 358 to determine once and for all a fixed calendar and send it in writing to the diaspora communities. And this was an act of immense religious and cultural importance, and certainly the result of lengthy astronomical research. According to the halacha, there were two ways that new months could be declared. One is by witnesses seeing the new moon, but that's called, that's al pi ha-re'iya, but also based on halacha l'moshe mi-sinai, when there is no Sanhedrin, so then you can use fixed calculations. And Hillel II used this second method in order to determine the new months when eventually it was prevented. It was the imperial authorities prevented rabbis from meeting to declare the new month. Now, one of the consequences of this innovation by Hillel II was that the diaspora was no longer dependent on the monthly decisions of the Sanhedrin in the land of Israel. This took place again about 70 years before the Sanhedrin was abolished. There were short-lived hopes and dreams for the Jewish people during the 4th century. In the year 351, the Jews of the Galil rose against Gallus, the Roman ruler of the east, and they hoped for Persian support, as Persian attacks had been frequent at this time. Eventually, the Jews were soundly defeated, and many cities in the Galil were destroyed. Additionally, the short reign of the Emperor Julian was a time of great hope for the Jews. He ruled in the year 360, and he adhered to the old Greek religion, and he sought to restore it by reducing the stature of Christianity in the empire, and he also sought to reestablish the Korbanos. In the summer of 362, he proclaimed his desire to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash and Yerushalayim, and the Jews were so excited, they began to settle in Yerushalayim. They began to expel the Christians from certain parts of the city. Unfortunately, Julian, he was known as Julian the Apostate. Julian was killed on June the 10th in 363 by a Christian Arab soldier, and the entire episode came to an end. Christian priests claimed that a fire miraculously destroyed part of the Mikdash, the temple, and other buildings that were built, but it may have been the Christians who actually destroyed these buildings. And from the death of Julian until the rise of Theodosius I in the year 379, there was no further anti-Jewish legislation. However, under Theodosius and his children until the abolition of the Patriarchate, the Nisiut in 425, the Christian church consolidated its power as the sole power of the empire, and the empire became less tolerant towards heretics. The Jews suffered in inverse proportion to the strength of the emperor's personality, who, if he was strong, would generally attempt to keep the peace and preserve justice between Jews and Christians. Early in the 5th century, the status of the last Nasi, Rabbi Gamliel, deteriorated. He was accused of contravening anti-Jewish imperial edicts by building synagogues, circumcising slaves, and sitting in judgment in a case between Christians. He was demoted to the title of honorable prefect. The abolition of the Nisiut of the Patriarchate formed part of the aims of the church for the very existence of this halo of royalty descending from King David, contradicted the Christian conception of their father, as the Messiah and the son of David. Leaders of the church consistently attempted to bring the Patriarchate into disrepute with fictitious reports of its spiritual decline and moral turpitude. The government abolished the Patriarchate after the death of Rabbi Gamliel, who was left with young sons, as the nation lost its institutional leader 350 years after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. Now, in the second half of the 4th century, the Talmud known as the Jerusalem or Palestinian Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi, was compiled in Eretz Yisrael, mostly in Tveria. Now this Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi, summarizes the entire thinking of the scholars of Eretz Yisrael during the 2 centuries following the conclusion of the Mishnah in the beginning of the 3rd century. This period lasted 5 to 6 generations, which are generally identified by the names of the heads of the yeshivos or other prominent figures. And again, it was completed around the year 400. The Talmud Yerushalmi takes the form of a commentary on the Mishnah. It is more than a commentary, as it often includes decisions on points that the Mishnah leaves open, as well as systematic or halachic discussions and additions that arose in the course of academic debate or in practical life. The text available to us covers only 4 of the 6 Sidrei Mishnah, Zrayim, Moed, Nashim, and Nezikim, and also part of Nida. The teachings of the Amoraim from Eretz Yisrael had considerable influence also in Bavel, and they are quoted in Talmud Bavli. For example, Rav Yochanan, Reish Lakish, Rav Ami, Rav Asi, a number of Amoraim from Eretz Yisrael are found in recorded in Talmud Bavli, although the Talmud Yerushalmi never achieved as much importance outside Eretz Yisrael as did the Talmud Bavli. What are some of the significant differences between the Talmud Bavli and Talmud Yerushalmi? So first, the language, a different Aramaic dialect. And for those who are in the middle of Daf Yomi now, so we're learning now the Sechah Shkolim, which is from the Talmud Yerushalmi, and that's a much more difficult, it's difficult to understand than the Talmud Bavli. We're used to the Talmud Bavli, this is a little more challenging. Another difference between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi is more fragmentary and difficult to read, as I just mentioned. The redaction of the Talmud Bavli was more careful and more precise, either because the redactors of the Yerushalmi had to finish their work abruptly, or perhaps the Bavli wasn't redacted for another 200 years, during which time a clear system of syntax was created. And a third difference is the scope. The Talmud Yerushalmi covers all of Zrayim, whereas Bavli only covers Brachos. Zrayim had little relevance outside Eretz Yisrael, so that's why we don't find that in the Talmud Bavli, but you find it most in Yerushalmi. However, the Talmud Yerushalmi does not cover Kachim, while Talmud Bavli does. In both, only one Masechta of Taros is included. The Talmud Bavli records opinions, as mentioned, of the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, whereas Yerushalmi rarely cites the rabbis from Bavel. Therefore, the Talmud Bavli is more comprehensive. But this is what's going on in Eretz Yisrael from around the year 300 to 425. Because Christianity rises, it becomes eventually the official religion of the Roman Empire. Life becomes a little more difficult for the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. The end of the Nisiut, you can't gather together to declare new moons. But Jewish people adapt, the calendar is established, and the Talmud Yerushalmi is completed. But it is certainly true that the spiritual center of Judaism has now shifted from Eretz Yisrael, which is declining, to Bavel, which is rising.